Good morning. It's nice to see so many people in here on a beautiful day outside. Welcome to the May 2011 meeting for SCCA. Would you all please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance? Pledge of Allegiance to the flag, United States of America, and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. We have a few members this morning, new members. We have the business members, All Pro Garage Doors. Are they here? Delaware Elevator of Florida. And Associated Financial Services, Mr. Greg Thompson. One of our vendors, Fountain Windows, who's been a vendor of ours for years, has just received from the state his full general contracting license, so he's a full general contractor, licensed and insured. So that's another good note for all of us that you can use if you need a GC. As far as the announcements go, our next President's Forum will be on June 11th. I'd like to thank ServPro South and West Brevard for all the goodies that you guys are eating here this morning. How about a round of applause? Thank you, ServPro. We also have here today a gentleman named Jeff from Southern Equipment. He has an all-plastic, rust-free shopping carts that are available individually. They're just under $200 a piece, but there are bulk discounts. These are fantastic for the condos on the beaches where, you know, we put them in our garages and everything rusts. I don't know why. But this is rust-free, and he brought one in. If you guys want to see it on the way out or whatever, take a look. It's quite a unique and a very well-built cart. So I just want to say thank you for bringing that down all the way from Daytona for us. And today's program is given by Clayton and McCullough. The name of the program is Your Association Going to the Dogs. Well, in some cases, probably. Mr. Neil McCullough.
Thank you, everyone, for having me here today. I got to see some of my clients. Hopefully, I get a chance to talk to them a little bit more before they leave today. Couple of things. Before I get started, I understood this seminar today that I'm putting on is going to be on, is your association going to the dogs, basically talking to you about various aspects of collections. However, I was informed that right when I was walking in the door, I actually needed to cover another topic, so we're actually going to have two seminars today. The first one we're going to talk about is emails. And it's funny that I was asked to specifically address this because of the significant problems that a lot of associations are having and the tremendous risks that they're incurring with respect to utilizing email. Now, in today's world, you know, everyone knows email is a fact of life. It makes all of our lives easier. We can keep up with people, get faster responses, especially if we can't get somebody on the phone. So email is, quite frankly, a lot of times the simplest, easiest, fastest, best method to communicate, get responses, and move things ahead. And that's all true. Very much so with your personal lives. As board members, though, you have a different problem. And you face different risks. Basically, when you start using emails, your risk can increase. And I just want to talk about that for a little bit. The first thing that we're seeing a lot of, and has been reported to me today, which is why I was asked to specifically deal with this topic, is the fact that a lot of associations and their boards are saying, okay, it's too hard to get together. We can't all meet at this time, and we have a special topic coming up. So rather than doing our monthly board meeting or whatever we're going to do, we need to make a decision quicker. I know. I'll just shoot an email to the other board members asking them how they want to proceed with this issue. In effect, we have a lot of associations today that are literally conducting board meetings by email. Well, no problem, right? Wrong. You're in violation of the Florida statutes, okay? As a matter of fact, you have all sorts of notice and meeting requirements, even for boards of directors, including posting. Do not forget that your membership has the absolute right to attend your board meetings, unless it's a privileged, confidential board meeting that you are having with your attorney regarding a confidential topic, which is usually dealing with ongoing or anticipated litigation. So outside of that one little caveat, everything else needs to be done in the sunshine, okay, out in the open, with notice, so that they have your input and so that they can see what's going on and sometimes voice their concerns. So there's part of the problem. If that wasn't bad enough, and I'll probably talk about these statutes a couple times during here, you know, you have all the statutory requirement of notice. Most of your documents within the framework of the documents themselves have notice, okay? And then you have two statutes. For those associations out there that are homeowners association, you have Florida Statute 720.305. I'll repeat it again. Florida Statute 720.305. For those of you that are in condominiums, 718.303. Okay? Now, why are those statutes important? Well, one, they help to give boards of directors, the association, and the management credibility. Why? Because essentially, if you go back and read those statutes, even though it doesn't use these words, here's what those statutes say. Every owner, every tenant, every association, board member, basically everybody under the sun, shall comply with this chapter. Now, when it uses the word chapter, that just means the statute and the association's governing documents. Hope everybody got that. So you've got to comply with the statute, which hopefully everybody knows anyway. You've got to comply with the governing documents. So a lot of times when you're failing to provide the requisite notice and holding the board meetings where the membership can attend, you're in violation of multiple statutes and the governing documents. By the way, at the end of that little section of both of those statutes, it does provide for the recovery of attorney's fees to the prevailing party. Not to mention that DBPR, the Department of Business and Professional Regulations, may cloud up and rain all over you for improperly holding board meetings. Okay? So if that's all we've got to worry about, no big deal, right? How about all the owners challenging the validity of whatever you decided? How about a lawsuit against the individual board members for breaching their fiduciary duty? Please do not forget that each board member owes a fiduciary duty to the association and its membership, which is the highest duty imposed by law. There is no higher duty. So understand you are exposing the association to risk and potential liability, and penalties from DBPR. You are exposing yourselves to individual risk and potential liability. Don't do it. Now, so far, what I've really talked about is the concept of using emails for meeting or voting on things. Okay? Another problem that exists out there, and I really don't like emails. As a matter of fact, when I email, 95% of the time when I'm emailing for work as opposed to in my personal life, I actually formalize a letter and send it by email. Do you know the reason? The reason is when most of us use email, we're very cryptic. Very cryptic. Oh, I'm just trying to get this thought across. Great. But in trying to get the thought across, your language may not be specific, and it may come back to bite you. You personally or the association. As an attorney, when we're getting involved in lawsuits, you know, okay, in today's world, guess one of the things that the other side always wants? Give us all your emails. Okay, well, I don't need to give it that because it was the president communicating with another director. So that I don't have to give that, right? Wrong. Okay? So when you're being cryptic and just trying to get a thought across, understand if something goes wrong, that can generally be discovered by the other side and used against you and the association. There's the danger. Okay? Another danger. Board meetings, by definition, transpire anytime you have a quorum of the board discussing association business. Okay? So, board members, if you go out to the golf course and you have a quorum of the board and you're just playing golf because you guys are just friends and you start discussing association business, that's a board meeting, has to be noticed. Well, Neil, what does this have to do with emails? Okay? You want to communicate with all the other board members, okay? And you send out an inquiry to all the other board members. That's a communication of a majority of the board, potentially a board meeting. So you get tripped up very easily on this topic. So the biggest thing I need to recommend on this is, one, whatever you do, don't ever vote by email if you can possibly avoid it. If for some reason you have an emergency, I understand that it's better to still get the consensus of some of the other board members. Even in that event, at your next board meeting, schedule it and have as an agenda topic to ratify the actions that have been taken. That should be used very seldom and in unique circumstances. That's the concern that I have. Basically, don't make decisions by email and be very cautious of what you put in an email. Do not think that it's going to be restricted to just Mr. Smith's eyes only. And there's the danger. And with that, I hope that covered the additional topic that was told to me to cover today. And now we'll go to the real topic that we were going to cover, and that's really on collections. You know, most everybody today realizes, and there's a handout, by the way, and for the first time, actually it's the second time in my life, I'm going to try to actually somewhat follow a handout rather than just stand up here and pontificate, which is my normal way. And most of you today are probably very aware of the laws. We've talked about two of them today. You know, the Condominium Act, 718, Homeowners Associations, which is 720. You also have, I don't know if there's any cooperatives, but if so, you have 719. Excellent. Okay? And then some of you may also have, on top of being a condominium, timeshare, and the Timeshare Act is 721. And then a new act that's become more and more important, and which is odd for associations, and that's Chapter 83, the Landlord-Tenant Act. And the reason that's become important, we'll discuss a little bit later, about obtaining rents from tenants, and that's where that one comes into playing. Now, there are certain rules of procedure that are out there that have also become very, very important. If you look on your outline, it's the second thing down. And you'll notice that we've pointed out the new pleading requirements of Rule 1.110. Now, what that's providing today is that mortgage foreclosure complaints have to be verified. Why is that important? Because of the fact that in a mortgage foreclosure complaint, we've had all sorts of problems. You've heard about three of the four big foreclosure mills across the state of Florida. All their cases have been taken away from them by the banks and lenders, okay? Why? Because of their practice, robo-signing, not having the correct information, and presenting incorrect information to the courts. A verified complaint is a sworn complaint. So whoever's filing a complaint has to put their John Hancock on it and say, I swear that this is true and accurate. Essentially, it's an affidavit verifying that the information contained in the complaint is true and accurate. Now, most people today aren't going to want to put their John Hancock on something unless they're more sure of it. In the past, what we've had is a lot of robo-signing, and all that meant is they just have someone, you know, they'd prepare paperwork and someone would sign it without having any knowledge of whether it was accurate, and a lot of it was being done with forms and without any copy of the notes and other things. So it was very problematic, and this is meant to protect the owners, and quite frankly, it has a significant degree of protection for associations. Now, the reason I want to talk about protection for associations is, and I'll get into this more later, is our concept that a lot of the approach that's out there is an approach where how do we limit how much we're going to spend or lose? My firm hates that approach. We think it's the wrong approach. Okay? Everyone's so scared we're going to lose. Associations can't collect. Garbage. Okay? What's our approach? What do we believe in? Let's go collect everything for you. Okay? We're going to talk in a little while about Coral Lakes, and everyone keeps telling me that Coral Lakes means we can't collect. We'll talk about Coral Lakes, because I think everybody misunderstands Coral Lakes completely, and I think the approach for associations is don't just sort of go after your collections. The approach shouldn't be, let's try not to run up, you know, or expend funds. The approach is, let's expend funds wisely so that we have a great opportunity of getting back everything we're owed, including any funds that we've run up trying to collect it. That's the approach that we believe everyone should be looking at. You know, under rules of civil procedure, you'll notice we also talk about the new form final judgment. Now, what's interesting about the new form final judgment is it very closely parallels the final judgment that my firm was trying to make all of the courts and mortgage foreclosure cases adopt and utilize. Before this ever came out, we sent attorneys basically all across the state challenging that, wait a minute, the mortgage company can't just wipe us out. Everybody thinks that, well, mortgage companies always wipe us out. No, not necessarily. And by the way, not the majority of the times. So this concept that you lose is a bad concept. And that's one of the things that I really want to get into today. And then you have the mandatory mediation process, which is probably going to slow a lot of things down, which basically in mortgage foreclosure is now going to require, okay, if we're going to do a mortgage foreclosure, before we go all the way through and get a final judgment at some point, we have to have mediation. And all mediation is, for those of you that have never been through one, is a structured settlement. That's all it is. It's where you get together with an independent third party, neutral, usually a judge or attorney, and he sets the both sides down and says, okay, you tell me your side. Okay, you tell me your side. You point out the downsides in this case. You point out the downsides in their case. And let's see if we can narrow the gap of what each party is claiming to where they can settle. And that's what a mediation essentially is. Mediations can work very effectively. They can help get things resolved. The other side of it, though, is in mediations and in a lot of short sales. You know, the concept is, oh, well, association, you need to give up everything that's owed to you. Really? Why do I want to give up anything? Someone going to make me? Okay? Don't forget, what you give up, you lose. What you lose, then, unless you have, you know, Uncle Guido that likes to just contribute extra money, goes back into an uncollected amount under your budget that then generally has to be spread amongst all the remaining owners that have already paid. In other words, Mr. Smith, who's already paid his assessment, which was hard enough anyway, is now being forced to contribute extra funds to pay the deficiency that is being raised or created by Mr. Jones not paying. And the problem that meets is we have a lot of people on fixed income. Well, a lot of these are very close. We can just make it. Well, guess what? You keep upping the amount they have to pay because you're not collecting from this group. You're going to make him be one that now may have to go into foreclosure. Very dangerous concepts, very dangerous approaches that are out there. And it's not, we're not trying to advocate that you can collect in all situations. Absolutely not. What we're saying, though, is a little different. Don't believe you can't. Look at each case individually. That's the key. And I'll talk more about that when we get into more of the mortgage foreclosures. Okay. Most of you know, but let me just cover it real quick. For condominiums, as most of you are aware, what you do before you can file a lien, you have to give a 30-day notice of intent to foreclose. HOAs, 45 days. Okay? Then you file your lien. After the lien is filed, then you have to, a 30-day notice of intent to lien, okay, it has to be done before you file a lien, 45 days for the condos. Then once that's done, you have to give another 30 days notice of intent to foreclose, again, 45 days for the condo. Now, the reason I go through that is one of the big things that's happened is the time over which it now takes to complete a foreclosure. Okay? It used to be we'd complete a foreclosure within 6 months. Unfortunately, now it's probably going to take a year. And that becomes important when you start evaluating what collection procedure you're going to use. And I hope each of you are going to use collection procedures, one, plural, and number two, use them. Don't just let people slide. Part of the reason I say that at this point is because for most associations, your boards of directors and your managers, your credibility is critical. If you lose your credibility, you're going to kill your ability to collect in the future. Okay? So when Mr. Smith sees Mr. Jones not paying and the association's taking little or no action, oh, why should I pay? And then we see a snowball approach. Okay? We see more and more people not paying, the receivables for the association skyrocketing because they're not using an aggressive approach. They're not convincing everybody that, hey, if you don't pay, the association is going to come after you and do everything it can to collect from you. Okay. Is that really going to happen, Neil? Is that really going to create a problem? Honest, true story. Within the last 6 months, I had one association came because I heard our firm is one, a little bit more aggressive, and number two, uses creative approaches, and three, tailors things to the association. So they came to see us. And they walked in the door, and they had 98% delinquencies. Just want that to sink in, 98. And I had, being the idiot I was, I had to ask, who's paying? And they said, I think it was four of the five people sitting at the table. It was something like that, okay? Now, basically it was only most of the board members. Nobody else was paying. That's a disaster. It is not uncommon today for associations to have a third of their accounts delinquent, 50% of delinquent. Don't let it happen to you. You know, it's funny. An association can afford to lose this collection. Lose it. Run up attorney's fees. I don't care. And lose it. You're saying, oh, we don't want to do that. Of course not. You know what you gain by that? By that expenditure, even if you have to pay the attorney? What do you gain? The statement back to all the other Indians, you don't pay, we're coming after you. You can't slide. Our credibility is intact. That's the critical aspect that I really want everybody to pay close attention to because I think it's absolutely critical. Okay. Once a complaint is filed, then understand part of the process is going to be inherently delayed. Why? Because you file the complaint, then we got to go get the process server or the sheriff to serve it. If we can't find them, we have to do this notice of publication. So there's built-in delays, and I want you to understand that because that's accounted for in the year time period. Once you've got the service of process, then they get 20 days to respond. And right now I'm really talking about the associations, and I'm really trying to follow the outline, which I'm terrible about doing usually. Okay. Once that occurs, then you're looking for the owner to respond. Usually that's going to be in the form of an answer and affirmative defense of saying, I either paid it, I don't owe it, stick it in your ear, I don't know. Okay? They can file motions suggesting that your complaint's invalid, like a motion to dismiss. If they don't file, then you move for summary judgment. Now let's switch to the mortgage foreclosure cases, which seem to be a lot of what's out there. And all of you that have been dealing with the mortgage foreclosures, you're sort of lulled for a while. Okay? Understand, we're expecting a giant wave of new mortgage foreclosures to hit. Hope everybody didn't hear a wave. They heard the word giant wave. Why? Remember what I said earlier, three of the four primary collection law firms for the banks and mortgage companies basically went bye-bye. Okay, you've seen all that stuff in the paper. So the banks have been scrambling, trying to get, okay, who's going to be our new law firm? What do you think happened to all those cases while this is happening? They've just been sitting for the most part. Okay? What do you think has happened to all the other cases that would have normally been filed if they had up-and-going law firms that could handle it? They haven't been filed. There's more and more delinquencies. There's a ton more mortgage foreclosures that you can expect coming down the pike. Okay. Once the mortgage company files a complaint, understand, the association should be added as a party. You should be sued. Okay? Well, wait a minute. We don't owe it. No, you're not being sued, provided it's an ethical law firm and company that's bringing the lawsuit. You're not getting sued, generally, to pay back the funds that's owed under the mortgage and note. You're being sued so that you can, it's like speak now or forever hold your peace. If you have a claim association and the mortgage company has filed its complaint, well, guess what? It's getting ready most of the time to wipe you out. Wait a minute, Neil. You said they may not be able to wipe us out. Yes, provided you jump into that lawsuit. You answer. You file your defenses. Okay? And so you need to step in or have a law firm step in. And a lot of law firms are saying, no, don't waste your funds. Really? I'm having problems with that. Okay? And I'll explain why in a little bit. With respect to going forward, if the association doesn't file the answer, then the mortgage company's attorney will literally get a default, basically saying you didn't answer, you no longer have any rights, you no longer have any claims, and the court can ignore you. Okay? Why is that important? Okay, well, on top of giving up all of your assessments, interest, costs, late charges, attorney's fees, whatever you've run up in the past, which you've now probably let go, if they complete their foreclosure. One other little problem, okay? Remember that little 12 months of assessments or 1% of the original loan amount that you get once a mortgage foreclosure is completed? Remember that? Well, Neil, we absolutely get that because it says so in the statute. So when they take title, we'll absolutely get 12 months or 1% of the original loan amount, whichever is less, because the statute says so, right? Wrong. Why? Because the banks became smart, and they said, you know what? The law firms aren't defending. They're not filing an answer. And if they are, they're just giving an appearance. They're not really responding to anything. How about we put in our motion that the association's owed Zippo, regardless of the statute? Okay, well, you say, well, I don't care. I've got the statute. No, you waived your rights on the statute because you didn't protect them under the lawsuit. There's the risk that's out there. And that's part of the reason you need to go forward. Okay. As I've said, a lot of the other law firms are taking, don't even waste your money. You're going to lose. Okay? And because of that, a lot of people have stopped. Or some law firms are just, oh, well, we'll just file an answer so when we know when it's all over. And we can try to collect the 12 months or 1%, provided they didn't wipe us out because we didn't do anything else. Okay? And a lot of this, as I said earlier, is predicated on a case that's called Coral Lakes. Great. Let's talk about Coral Lakes, because everything I hear about Coral Lakes is that Coral Lakes completely wipes out associations from their ability to collect once a mortgage foreclosure is filed. That's what I've heard. I really wish people would read Coral Lakes. Coral Lakes is a retroactive impairment of contract case that involves a homeowners association. So I want everybody to understand, Coral Lakes, H-O-A. Notice I didn't say condo, H-O-A, okay? You heard me say retroactive impairment of contract case. Let me explain what that means. All that means is, okay, our laws change all the time, every year. We have new amendments to the statutes every year, okay? And because of that, we have an evolution of the statute, okay? Well, it's the predisposition of people, including attorneys, to say, okay, we just look at the law that's in effect today. But wait a minute. What if we entered into a contract 20 years ago? The law that was in effect when we drafted this contract to deal with the laws that existed 20 years ago, okay, was set back here, predicated on these laws. We didn't have the crystal ball to tell us that, wait a minute, this is what the law was going to be. So we didn't draft the contract to deal with the laws 20 years later. We drafted it to deal with laws 20 years ago. So the concept of a retroactive impairment of contract is that the legislature should not be able to retroactively impair a contract with its new laws. So you have to go back and look at the law that was in existence at the time of the contract. Does everybody sort of understand that? Let me add one word, sometimes. Okay, now, how does that work? Well, it's real simple. The answer is if the change in the law is procedural as opposed to substantive, that means something real, I guess, then the law, as it changes, applies to the old contract. So procedure things, new law, as it changes, are still applicable. Substantive items, real big items, now you go to the law that was in existence as the contract was entered. So far, so good? That's pretty much what Coral Lake says. I'm giving you a layman's explanation. I hope you understand that, but I'm trying to make it so it's really understandable. Fine. Okay, Neil, can you explain the difference between procedural and substantive more than you have? Because I really don't get the fine distinction. I'm really glad to tell you that I have a great explanation for you, and that is I don't have a clue. Most things are both substantive and procedural. So the easy way is a lot of times our statutes will tell us this is meant to have, you know, to clarify the law that has existed, sort of tells us. I love it when they do that, because otherwise we all get to argue as attorneys because it's more gray. But now here's the issue. When you go back to the HOA Act, which has been evolving and evolving and evolving, and it's gone X, not X, X, not X, okay, you've got to look back. And what Coral Lakes did is said, well, wait a minute. We have a real old mortgage here. There was no provision for the 12 months or 1%. The documents basically said lender gets out of everything. Association, you don't get anything, including the 12 months or 1%. Ooh, very dangerous case. It is. If you meet all the facts and criteria, it's an absolutely killer case. Sort of. Why? What are the facts and criteria? You've got to look at the laws. And you realize that a lot of the association documents out there say, we adopt 720 as it's amended from time to time. You just keep going. The new statute comes into effect. Same thing on 718, the Condo Act. Okay? So that's one of the big things. One of the other things I love about Coral Lakes is I keep hearing Coral Lakes wipes out everybody. I think this is really interesting. If you have a 1997 mortgage, do you realize what Coral Lakes probably stands for? You're owed 100%. All your interest, late charges, attorney's fees, costs. Why? Because the statute in 2007 said, associations, you get 100%, regardless of who takes title. Okay? Well, so that's one of them. Let me point out one. And this was, we were having an attorney lunch Thursday. And one of the cases came in, and it's even the attorneys. And we've got one that's come in, which I'm just dying. It's can't even believe it. Because Coral Lakes and what people have come to believe it means has been so, pardon me, bastardized that I think even some of the attorneys are starting to believe it. And so they wrote in, and they've got this big lawsuit, and they're saying, our client doesn't owe you anything, and you're slandering the title, and you can't get from it. My client purchased at the judicial sale at the mortgage in the mortgage foreclosure, not the mortgage company. One of the things I think would be really neat is if people go back and read the statute, okay? It's real interesting. Why? Condominiums. You know who get the protection under the statute for a mortgage foreclosure? It's not a third-party purchaser at a foreclosure sale. Mortgage company or its assignee, not a third party. Just read the statute. It's black and white. By the way, one of the other things is everybody has to understand that 12%, 12 months or 1%, you realize that's a safe harbor. Mortgage company, you only have to pay this. Does anybody bother to read the provided you do this? No, there's requirements there. Anybody bother to look at those? They're real important. Why? Because guess what? Mortgage company or its assignee. Okay, now I have a question. You all just think through this, all right? Because it's what dictated how my firm approaches all this stuff. Do you really think all the banks are really foreclosing in their name? So, okay, do you really think they've assigned all these properly using proper assignment instruments? Guess what? That's what we found. So when we do mortgage foreclosure cases, we look at each one. All we're trying to do is find you didn't dot this I or you didn't cross this T. Got it? Great. Well, the bank said, well, of course we're not. I've been assigned the right to foreclose it. No, that's not the right you have to get assigned. You got to get the whole thing assigned to you. Okay? What about if they don't have the note mortgage? You guys have heard about that. So what are we really looking at? We're looking at them on an individual basis, figuring out what can we contest. Well, that's going to cost a fortune. Really? Interesting. Let me tell you, my firm, We're so confident in it. Remember way back when nothing ever completed foreclosure because real estate prices were going up so fast? You know what we used to charge to do a mortgage foreclosure? $250. Why? We'd answer, we'd get paid off, it was done. And I'm talking a decade ago, actually over, even more than that. Okay? Do you know what we charge now? $250. Do you know what it's for? Cover some of the costs. Balance. The balance is on a pure contingency. You pay us nothing more. Why? Because we have that greater success record. We're not worried about it. By the way, pure contingency, let me explain that. Most people think of a contingency like an automobile case. You know, if you recover, the attorney gets 30% or 40% of whatever you got. Remember that? No. You get 100%. We're trying to collect 100% of all your attorney's fees, costs, interest, late charges, whatever. The whole thing. Assessments, you get all of it. What do we get? We got to collect the attorney's fees. Not as part of what you got. No, we got to collect the attorney's fees. Understand what that means. Gives you an idea how confident we are in what we're doing. And we're very concerned about the law and the approach that associations are taking. They're taking a sit back and wait approach. They're taking, we don't want to run up fees. Well, it's not a very much money, $250 to protect yourself in a mortgage foreclosure and everything's on the law firm. By the way, we're getting about, from what we've gotten so far, unless something changes, and it could, about 80 to 90%. Pretty high ratio, guys. Okay. By the way, Coral Lakes is beating us in a handful of cases. Very rare. But if we go through it and we can't find the I or the T to dot, okay, we can't find the discrepancy, guess what? We give. And we'll talk about some of the other approaches in a minute. But rather than looking at your collections as something, and especially mortgage foreclosure, oh, we just have to back away. Or we have to take a sort of okay approach. Okay, or a minimal approach. Guys, come on. The vast majority of the cases are turned over to us, we're still collecting as part of the collection aspect, not even in the mortgage foreclosure. Okay. One of the other things that is out there, creative strategies. That's what it's labeled here. What I talk about, a little bit different, choose the approach that fits you, not your law firm. I keep hearing about, oh, well, here's the latest and greatest approach. Okay? And this law firm say, well, this is the latest and greatest approach. Well, this is what you must do. This works the best. And you know what? That's because we like to gear it to where this is our system. It's all we're going to do. We're not going to get out of our box. Okay? This is our system, and it's the best. Really? I would think the system that's the best is predicated on a case-by-case approach, not even an association-by-association approach. That's what we're going to talk about now. Okay, there's avenues of recovery that are out there. Okay, one of the avenues of recovery that's out there, and you all have heard about receivers of rents. Okay, now, receiver of rent, it's a great remedy. Okay, it really is. Love it. Provided you have multiple delinquent accounts where the unit is being rented. Okay? If you don't have that, I don't like it. Why? Because there is a cost of having a receiver, having him appointed, and then paying the receiver. Now, normally, a lot of the receivers will take it on out of whatever the rents they collect, but there is a cost. So to justify that, you want to usually have multiple. I like 10. You might see 5 periodically, but I like at least 10. And in that case, there are significant advantages. Why? Because if you're using a statutory receiver of rents or even an equitable approach to get the receiver of rents provided, and by the way, statutorily it's provided you can do this, what you're doing is you're having the court, by court order, say, I am appointing a receiver. We try to do it in general. I got to talk about limited and full. But try to get it for a receiver appointed for all this association's delinquent accounts, okay, where the unit has been rented. Okay, now, once he's got the court order, a tenant doesn't pay him, contempt of court, throw him in jail. That's one. Number two, association, guess what? You don't have to do anything about it. It's all by the receiver. Number three, usually we can get the receivers to take their recovery out of the rent. That's going to mean you're going to get a little bit less of the rent, but hopefully in the long run you'll still get paid everything. So I still like the receiver of rent approach, but you need multiple. Otherwise, it's not cost justifiable, okay? And you have to have a lawsuit, okay? Now, we've been very fortunate that a lot of our judges are saying once you have one lawsuit, Mr. Smith is delinquent, and whether you're in your foreclosure or even a mortgage foreclosure complaint, you have the court appoint the receiver. We've had most of our judges say once he's appointed, all of your accounts can go to him that fall in that category. It's called a global, we call it a global receiver, okay? Unfortunately, there's one or two judges that say, no, you have to have a separate lawsuit in existence and the appointment by the judge each and every time. So it depends a little bit on the judge. All right. Let's talk a little bit about collecting rent from, back from the owner. You'll see that. But that is really primarily predicated on you've completed your foreclosure. I'm not talking the mortgage foreclosure because we've got to make them apples and oranges. And you've got your judgment. And now we've got to wait, I don't know, X amount of days before the property actually gets sold and all this stuff. Well, there's a statute that provides you're entitled to get rent during that time period. So that's one of the things that's up there. You know, we're talking about collecting rent from owners. One of the effective remedies, and it was really funny to watch what's happened in the collection arena, because the standard approach used to be you'd get two or three letters from the management company of a delinquency back to the delinquent owner. It would go to the law firm. The law firm or the management company would have the notice of intent lien letter sent, the notice of intent, and then the lien filed, and the notice of intent to foreclose sent, and then go forward with the foreclosure. And everybody goes, well, wait a minute, that has this cost associated with it. We don't want to do that. Okay? Interesting. What's come about is a lot more associations are going back to that. Why? I want, if I can have some hands. How many people are aware of mortgage foreclosures that are taking a minimum of a year? Minimum of 2 years? 3 years? 4 years? 5 years? Everybody still notice hands are up? Problem. While this is going on, unless you have a receiver of rents appointed or you're using the new statutory method to collect rents, and I'll talk about that in a little while, what's happening? You're not getting your money. Your assessments aren't getting paid, not the interest, the late, none of that. So at best, you've got this big delayed payment. And as more and more people become in arrears, the amount of funds necessary to carry the association is being borne by fewer and fewer people. And despite the association's efforts, it's still starting to erode the credibility of the board and the managers. Okay? Because it's hard to explain to people, look, we're fighting, we're in the mortgage foreclosure, but it's not over yet. It's been going on for 4 years. I know it. You know it. Explaining that to owners doesn't make a whole lot of sense a lot of times. So a lot of our associations are saying, okay, is there an option? How about it? What if we go back to the old procedure? This was the old procedure, okay? What if we go ahead, even if there's a mortgage foreclosure, and we complete our lien foreclosure? Remember, you have your lien rights and the mortgage is over here. What if we just go complete it? Well, Neil, come on. Now we take the title to the unit, we got to pay off the bank. No. Last time I checked, my associations didn't sign on that dotted line on the note and mortgage. You're not going to pay them off. You're not going to give them squat. They've been shafting you. Shaft them back. I'm sorry, I'm real upfront. I just say it the way it is. They really do. I won't use the colloquial term I was going to use. They make me mad. It was going to be a different phrase, but I'll try to behave up here. Okay? Well, what if we take title? Okay, well, now we've got title. Okay, how about we rent it? And we keep the rent while we're waiting for the mortgage company to complete its mortgage foreclosure. Okay? Now understand, if there's a tenant in there, you might use the receiver approach. These are two different approaches. But a lot of times you just have the owner. You know what? I'm just going to live here. I'm not going to pay anybody. And the mortgage company is probably going to take 5 years, so I got free rent, and y'all can just stick it in your ear. Well, that's not sitting very well with most owners. Notice I didn't say boards, I didn't say associations. You want to talk about the people that get that make the owners the angriest? Them. And they come to the board, and they yell at you, why aren't you doing something about this? We've got various approaches. Again, what if we take title? Well, wait a minute. That means we have to complete the foreclosure, and that's got these expenses. Yeah? So what are you doing? You're gambling. Okay? So you got to decide whether it's a good gamble. Part of that is, how long do you think it's going to be before the mortgage foreclosures are completed? Okay? If you think it's going to be 5 years, this may not be a bad idea. Maybe a great idea. Maybe four, maybe three. Don't forget, a lot of times the rent is higher than the amount of the monthly assessments, or in an HOA's case, the annual or whatever you're doing. Okay? Now, if you do this, we don't recommend that you just do a normal rent. Why? We're trying to get money back for you as quick as we can. Do a fire rent. Y'all have heard about a fire sale. How about a fire rent? You're trying to reduce the price for two reasons. One, get someone in quickly. Start paying the rent. Start getting your money back to defray the expenses, the cost, the attorney's fees, the assessments, the interest, all that. Number two, the other reason, is because we need to add and have a very special lease, very complicated. Okay? Does everybody understand that? Okay? So all the leases have to have a very, very important provision that's highly complicated. Essentially, in case the mortgage company completes its foreclosure, tenant, you agree to leave. That's the complicated lease provision. Why? Because you can't guarantee when the mortgage company will complete its foreclosure, so you can have a year lease, but you have to have that out in case they complete it. You can tell I like to be sarcastic periodically. But that's all there is. Take a normal lease, shove in one line. You're done. Okay? And that's part of the reason you consider reducing the rent. Here's the funny thing. We have more and more associations going back to the old way of doing it and completing them. Because more and more are believing completing the mortgage foreclosure will be years. And we have associations that are making money. Okay? We have some that have far exceeded what they are going to get, you know, what that was owed. Because, hey, remember, the bank was shafting you. Okay? Why do we care? Now, I got to point out something. Remember we talked about the receiver of rent? I need you all to understand the banks probably have a right to appoint a receiver of rent, and their claim under the receiver may be superior to yours to where they get the rent first. Well, then we definitely don't want to do it. Neil? Really? Let me point out one thing. In dealing with all the collection cases that I've done, my firm's done, that I've heard about, not just within my firm, but ever, do you know how many times I've ever heard of a bank having a receiver of rent appointed so that they can get the rent from the tenant of a delinquent owner? Never heard of it. As best I can tell, the attorneys that do that have blinders. And these blinders are about, I don't know, 6 inches thick, and they go for 2 miles. They know how to do one thing. They can't get out of the box. So I've never seen that. I got to admit it's a risk. I've just never seen it come to fruition. Okay. Let's talk about that new statute that exists out there. Okay. There's a new statute that exists whereby, under the statute, if an owner is delinquent, after providing notice to the owner and the tenant, the association can essentially collect rents from the tenant. It's a great thing to use. I like trying it. Please do not believe that that's the cure-all. Why? Okay. Remember the limitation on the receiver of rent? First, you have to have the delinquent unit that is being rented. Same thing here. Owner-occupied doesn't help you. What else is a problem? There's a couple of things that are a problem under this. One of them is not just the notice, but there's limitations in the statute. Essentially, you can only collect up to the amount of the delinquent assessment, and generally that's going to be prospective, not retroactive. So if someone owed something 3 years ago, nah, at least not right now. Who knows what the new when they correct some of the things in the statute, they may add that back. But right now it's prospective, so think of it that way. That's a minor limitation. That one doesn't worry me very much. There's another cap, though. So it's the maximum of your assessment or the amount of unpaid rent before the notice. Okay? So what does that mean? That means you have to know the amount of the rent. Now, for those associations out there that have the provision in their documents that says, okay, we get to approve your lease, we get a copy of your lease, so we know how much the rent is, we're good to go. By the way, you also sort of need to know who the tenant is. So having the lease is great. A lot of your documents don't provide for that. Now, does that mean that you can't try to use this remedy? No. You know, you can send it to tenant. Okay? We have created forms to reduce your risk where it's saying, okay, you need to pay us your rent, and then it's sort of like up to blank. So that what we're doing is saying you are not violating the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. In other words, you have to carefully word it, and you need to make sure that you're not stepping out of the confines of what the statute permits or the other regulations. So it's one of those things that needs to be done correctly. But I do like it. And if you're one of the associations that actually has copies of the leases and know what the amount of the rent is and the name of the person, you're even in better shape. Okay? What other limitations exist? Well, my biggest problem with it is the remedy. Delinquent owner says, I don't know who you are. I don't care. I don't believe you know what the statute says, and I'm not going to read it. And I know Sammy Joe, who's renting me his apartment over here, and I'm paying Sammy Joe. Okay? Now, association. You know that you've got a statute behind you, so you can go after him. Great. Minor problem. What's the remedy? Eviction. Now, I must be missing it, because the last time I checked, if you evict the only person that has the money, I'm trying to figure out how we're going to get the future rent. Am I missing something? Because it's one of the limitations. Do not get me wrong. I am not suggesting you don't use this remedy. I'm not considering you don't try to bluff your way through it. I'm saying that at times it doesn't work. And I've got associations that are using more creative strategies, one that is, at least some of the managers are here today, that are doing things like in a private gated community, okay? Creative strategy. By the way, everybody realize I recommend strongly against this. Got that? What I'm getting ready to say, I recommend strongly against. Everybody got it? I've now protected my malpractice carrier. Now we can talk about reality. You know how guys have this affinity with the clicker for the TV? You notice every person laughing out there is a woman? I was going to kick out of that, because guys really do. Do you know the remote control that is more important to a guy than a TV remote? If you're in a gated community, you have two choices on the gates. You have the gate that goes by the guard where he stops you, and the line at rush hour is like 20 minutes, okay? And then you have the gate that you can just zip right through. Oh, that clicker is even more important than the remote control for the TV. So what if we turn off the guy's clicker? One of the most effective remedies I have ever seen. Everybody got that I recommended against that, right? Difference on whether something's effective versus whether you can be challenged and at risk for doing it, okay? And believe me, there's people in this room that are aware of at least one that it's working great on, okay? It is amazing. People may not be able to afford their mortgage. They may not be able to afford food, but by God, they will have that clicker. And you all are laughing. I can't tell you how effective this is. Let me tell you a little bit about why I really don't recommend it, okay? And it has to deal with a couple of things, all right? And the main one has to deal with your ability to impair an owner or resident's ingress and egress rights. Okay? By the way, believe it or not, I actually think the risk is greater for a homeowner association doing this than a condo. Okay? Believe it or not, it has to do with the slight different change in the wording. By the way, the difference in wording is impair versus preclude. Okay? HOA uses the word impair, and I believe the word for condos is preclude, which is complete stoppage. Okay? Impair means infringe upon. All right, well, I think any time you're not going to let them use something, that's an impairment. There's also a development in the case law that came out with associations putting in speed bumps on their private roads. And it basically said that in that particular instance, the association couldn't do it. You're going, that's dumb. By the way, I do believe it's absolutely ludicrous and stupid, but I just live with the law. I don't always get to create it. And the reason that they said was, it's an unreasonable infringement and impairment on a person's ingress and egress rights, okay? Because I guess they have to slow down to go over this hump. I must have missed it, because if I was a judge, I'd go, wait a minute. The reason you put those in there is to slow people down so they don't run over people, and especially kids that are running through cars. I would think that's a slightly more important right than a person having to slow down. But in any event, that exists. So the impairment issue is a risk that associations face. Stay tuned. We still haven't had the court case on it. And now I'm going to tell you something I probably shouldn't. Okay? Remember, I recommended against it. Why is it that so far we haven't had the court case? I've often wondered, if Mr. Smith doesn't have the money to pay his assessments, does he really have the funds to go hire an attorney to sue the association because they're wrong? Interesting practical issue, not a legal issue. Okay. Let's talk for a second about, by the way, I'm trying to figure out how much time I have. Okay, I think I'm still doing pretty good. He's easily pleased. Ask his wife. Okay. I had to do that. You have to understand, I've known him for a long, long time, guys. I do this all the time. All right. Let's talk about, you know, I mentioned this earlier. Once a judgment's entered, okay, a lot of times the owner's still sitting there. You can make them pay rent. I mentioned this earlier. There's a statute, and it's 720.3085-1D, okay? 720.3085-1D, okay? For the condos, it's 718.116, paren 6, paren C. And what this essentially provides, and I'll just do the one out of the 718, if the unit owner remains in possession of the unit after a foreclosure judgment has been entered by the court, in its discretion, it may require the unit owner to pay a reasonable rental for the unit. So what the judge is doing, it's saying, okay, guys, you've really milked the association and all the owners left and right now for umpteen years. You haven't paid squat. You no longer own it. And while the unit hasn't been sold yet, so still technically it's still in your name, how about we reserve the rights to the courts to make him pay a rent to stay there until the unit is completely sold and or until he is escorted out by the sheriff or an eviction? So that's one of the ones that exist to be able to help associations in doing that. There's one other one that I did want to talk to you about that I think is very important. Part of what my firm tries to do is give the association the best opportunity to collect 100% of its assessments, interest, costs, and attorney's fees. Okay? We're not trying to figure out, and if you're looking to have someone figure out, how do we make sure that we don't spend anything, or how do we make sure that we don't expose anything, we're probably not the law firm for you. Why? Because our concept is to try to get 100%. We're not trying to get part of it. Heck, we're not even really big. You know, we keep hearing about, you have these short sales, and the association has to give up, you know, you just need to, you know, give up everything. Well, and the reason you need to do this is because if the short sale goes through, you'll have someone and he'll pay future assessments. Oh, well, absolutely. We'll give up $10,000 to get someone in the future. I'm not even saying that's always wrong. I'm just saying don't just jump at it. How about we look at how good your case is? Okay? If they haven't dotted an I and crossed their T, how about we just say stick it in your ear? Well, Neil, that means we're going to be delayed further. Yes. But what if you get all that funds in the future? Don't forget, when we're trying to collect all the assessments, we're also trying to get all the late charges. We're also trying to get all the interest. Hope you all realize that a lot of these interest rates are 18%. That's a lot of additional cash flow for some of your associations, provided we collect. So if we collect late, sometimes for associations, it's hard during the interim. It's a cash flow problem. But it can be a big boon to the association at the tail. Okay? And a lot of times, people redeem right at the end. They settle with the bank. Or a lot of times, these short sales, okay, someone to pony up to make the deal go through, it just won't be the association. Then the other aspect of it is a lot of the short sales don't go through. So you also have to be a little bit concerned about how much time and effort you're actually doing to make a short sale go through. The other one I wanted to talk about is what we call an assignment of rent provision. Now, most of the mortgages have this in it, and you want it. By the way, ours, if we're going to put one in your documents, is going to be about a page long by itself. But it's succinctly what it says is, in the event that an owner is delinquent and a unit is rented, the owner assigns the rent to the association, and the association can collect the rent directly from the owner. Okay? Now, everyone's right now saying, well, wait a minute. Isn't that sort of the receiver of rents and the new statute? Not exactly. What this does is allows you to elevate your rights even further. Now, I'm going to come back and talk to you about something I did earlier when I started speaking. Remember when I raised 718.303 and 720.305? That's the provisions of the HOA Act and the Condominium Act that said all owners, tenants, invitees, basically the world, has to comply with this chapter and the governing documents. I want to slow down a minute and repeat that and just leave out some things. Every tenant must comply with. Everybody get that? And it's a violation of Florida law if they don't. And the association is entitled to attorney's fees. So why does this escalate your rights? Well, what if once you have this passed, you go tell Mr. Tenant, you have to pay us. And he says, stick it in your ear. And you say, really? Okay. He goes, and I'm going to keep paying the owner. And you'll say, fine. You'll still have to pay us. No, I don't. Yes, you do. No, I don't. Yes, you do. Here's the statute that says, 718-303, 718-305, tenant, see the word tenant here? Shall comply with? By the way, we've just put this assignment of rent in the association's declaration, one of the governing documents that statute says you shall comply with. One of the statutes says shall, the other one says must. Of course, we have to have a difference between the two. Okay? And you're going to tell us, tenant, you don't have to? Here's the copy. Please feel free to pay the owner. You'll still have to pay us, and we have the right to come after you to pay that. Okay? Oh, and Mr. Tenant, please notice the very last portion of this statute, which says the prevailing party is entitled to recover attorney's fees. Notice what this does. A lot of what I'm talking about, both in terms of the assignment of rent provision that can be placed into your declaration, of course, it's amendment, you got to get the approval. We'll talk about that a little bit more. But as well as this new statute that allows you to go try to collect rent from a tenant, what is it? The biggest thing what you're doing is trying to maximize your leverage. Don't get me wrong. To the extent that you can curtail attorney's fees and get paid quicker, do it. Okay? I think every one of you needs to have a standard collection approach that gets deviated depending on the facts in place. That's one. I'd have it formally adopted by the board at a board meeting with notice. I would have whatever that is made sure to be mailed out to the owners okay? And the residents, why? Because I want the tenants to get it as well. Why? I want everybody to know what the game is. I want to build the credibility. So once you tell them, here's how it's going to work, and they step out of line, you take the club and you go, boom! And then everybody else starts with, oh, they really meant business. That's the credibility factor. But do not tell everybody, here's what we're going to do, and then don't do it. That's the worst thing you can do. But if you have a defined collection policy adopted by the board, notice to the owners and the residents to where they all on advance notice of what it is, how it's going to work, what the timetables are, etc. Everybody now knows the game. Now when you start implementing the game, your credibility goes up. And I have some associations that are doing a masterful job. I have some associations probably have their owners and tenants a little scared. Good for them. Okay? You may think that's harsh. Well, I don't know, but we represent over 700 associations. I'm tired of seeing my clients get the short end of the stick all the time. You know, I want my clients to be aggressively pursuing this so that they are not the ones left holding the short end of the stick, where the remaining good owners that are paying are having to pony up for people that aren't. Now, that's different, and this is one of the other things I want to talk about. Then there's owners that have lost their job, can't pay. I got that. Okay? That's the nature of what's happening in our economy, our state, and our nation. Do not make them feel any guiltier. Do not publish a dunning notice, a delinquency list. By the way, it's illegal. Okay? But that's different than owners that can pay or banks, et cetera, that are shafting us. There's the difference. There's a dividing line. And I do think an aggressive policy is important. And the other thing is, even for those owners that are struggling, there's a priority of expenses that each owner must evaluate. I just don't want our expenses to be at the bottom. Your expenses are important. For most people, where they live is their single most important investment. Protect it well. In today's world where our property values have plummeted for HOAs and condos have sunk even further, to allow massive delinquencies to exist can crush you. On top of that, it can hurt you if you need to borrow money. You know, you heard the 6% versus 18%. As can leasing. Leasing amendments are becoming more and more important and undertaken to curtail the number of leases so that people can get secondary financing. But those are the big issues that I see that are out there that you can consider utilizing. And the biggest thing I want to leave everyone with is the concept of don't be talked into an approach. Evaluate your conditions and at times adjust it for the unique facts. Okay? We used to refuse, literally, don't care what anybody told us, would not accept a payment plan that was longer than 6 months. Literally would not, period. My firm would not do it. Association would say, well, we want a 9-month. No. Why? Because we thought we'd hurting our associations. Today, if you can get somebody on a payment plan and they'll live up to it, really consider it. Why? Why turn it over to somebody else to collect if you can get the money? Why put somebody else on the delinquency if you can get some of it and they can really bring it current? Today's world is one where you need to not just gloss over your rights. Don't just believe the little one-line sentence about this is the cure-all or this case kills us. No. Cases are predicated on facts and on the statutes. I can't tell you, the biggest thing I can do, and the reason I actually tell you about the way my firm works on mortgage foreclosures is, if we didn't believe this, do you really think we would take essentially all the attorney's fees, matter of fact, it's all the attorney's fees, plus some of the costs on a pure contingency? Okay? Nobody in their right mind would do it. Well, if we're doing it, we believe in it, okay? I wonder whether you all should just be giving up the ship because people don't want to look at everything on a case-by-case basis. They want to globalize because it's quicker, cheaper, faster. And with that, I'm going to open it up for questions, and I understand I have a written question that I'm supposed to start with. And then I'll open it up, I guess, to the floor or written questions if anybody wants to hand them in. This question, I'm going to read it verbatim. Our condo has 200-plus units, and it has in its rules and regulations for the past 20 years a section on pets, which reads, pets, one dog, a weight not to exceed 25 pounds, three vets, period, proof required. My question is, if an owner slash tenant moves into a unit and brings along with them two small dogs or a large dog weighing over 25 pounds limit, after being interviewed and signing a statement not revealing this situation until we catch it on the premises, what immediate action can the board take? All right. I didn't talk about one alternative collection remedy that's out there that I think is the most effective, but everybody needs to understand I really don't recommend this one, and that's the 357 Magnum. Okay. The problem that I'm seeing with this is I'm hearing a couple of things. I'm hearing the word rule and regulation, and I don't know whether that's in the declaration or a board-adopted rule and regulation, so I'm going to cover that. And then I'm going to use the phraseology of the rule, as I understand it, literally reads. I need everybody to understand your declaration. Some of you call them CC&Rs or covenants and restrictions. That document and the provisions therein can be, to a degree, unreasonable and still be enforceable. Okay? Let me give you the best example I can. Okay. I need everybody to understand and do a predicate, because this will probably come up more and more. And by the way, if you ever have to explain to people why they have to pay assessments and why they have to abide by the pet rule or anything else, this may come in handy. Everybody needs to understand, your declaration should constitute what's called a covenant running with the land. And all that means in English is that declaration is recorded in the public records at the same place where the deeds are recorded, but it's recorded prior in time to the deed by which each owner took title to his lot or unit. Got that? So we just have public records, deck recorded first, then the deeds are after it. So every owner is on record title notice of everything that's in his chain of title, in other words, what's been recorded, and has tacitly agreed to abide by everything therein. Why? Because what's in the declaration predates the deed, therefore it's superior. So far, so good. Okay. Now, on top of that, please everybody remember 718 303 and 718-305 that says, by law, you have to comply with everything. So we got two reasons, right? So the declaration takes precedence over everybody's deed, and everybody has to comply with the declaration. Got that? Great. Now, in that declaration, we have this amendment provision, which says if we get X percentage of the owners to vote in favor of this amendment, okay, that amendment passes, and it becomes part of the declaration. Everybody agree so far? Great. We're having collection problems. Isn't it funny? I get to work collection into a dog case. I'm having real fun here. Okay, now, everyone's having collection problems. And in every community, there's a Mr. Mean. Now, Mr. Mean is a guy everybody hates. Nobody wants Mr. Mean in the community. They want his sorry butt out of here. I got a great idea. Let's amend the declaration, get the requisite approval, follow the procedures to amend the declaration to say, Mr. Smith, who's Mr. Mean, by the way, no longer owns his house or his condominium unit. It's owned now by the association. Everybody remember? Declaration takes precedence. Mr. Mean was on notice that if we get this percentage, we can amend it, right? Mr. Mean, you no longer own your house. Right? Wrong! Everything up until about then was truthful. By the way, y'all do know how to tell when attorneys are lying, right? Whenever their lips are moving. Okay. The problem is there are some rights that are so paramount. They're so constitutionally protected. We call them vested rights or constitutionally protected rights. That regardless of a provision or an amendment provision within your governing documents, they cannot be divested or taken away from an owner without his personal consent. Does that make sense? That's one of those rights. The reason I go over that is, guess what? If you put stuff in the declaration, especially in the original one, man, it can be massively unreasonable. It's when you start doing things later and what level of approval you get that they have higher challengeability. Okay? I'm going to go to the other extreme just to really flesh this out. Now, well, Neil, now you've sort of undermined the provisions in the declaration. Really? Okay, last time I checked, I think the only entities that should be able to tax are governments, and the only entities that should be able to take your home away from you if you don't pay your tax is the government. I hope each of you know that all your associations have a taxing right, and if the people don't pay that tax, you can take their home away. We've been talking about it all day today. It's your assessment lien foreclosure right. Totally unreasonable, okay? Not partially. Why can you do it? In the deck. Covenant running with the land, plus that statute, okay? So what I need everybody to understand is, okay, whatever's in this deck is highly, highly enforceable. So far, so good? Now let's jump down. There's a hierarchy of priority of documents. The declaration controls over the articles of incorporation, which controls over the bylaws, which controls over the board adopted rules and regulation. Hope everybody heard. Board adopted rules and regulation are way down. Okay, provisions in the declaration can be to a degree unreasonable and still be enforceable. Provisions within the rules and regulations, the board adopted rules and regulations, must be reasonable to be enforceable. Get the different standards of challenge right there. So you start doing rules and regulations, higher degree of challengeability. Number two, rules and regulations cannot conflict with any superior document. So you can't have a provision that says owners can have all the pets they want, regardless of size, and then implement a one dog rule. Would conflict. Okay? Can't implement a no pet over 25 pounds. By the way, in a minute we get to talk about the fat dog defense. Y'all think I'm joking. I'm not. Okay. So there's the problem I see with this. Now let's deal with the language. I need you all to understand the provisions within your governing documents are primarily construed against the drafter. All that means in English is if there's an ambiguity, whoever wrote the document, you lose. It's construed against you. Next, it's construed against the entity or individual seeking to enforce it. Okay? Who's that going to be? Association. Got that? So when I read a rule that says pet, then it drops down, colon, number one, one dog. I'm not sure that's saying the only kind of pets you can have is a dog. I'm not sure that's saying you can only have one dog. I'm not sure what that's saying. It's not, the wording of it worries me. Number two says, a weight not to exceed 25 pounds. I'm not sure if that's the weight of his collar. And yes, I'm being unreasonable, but I'm trying to use the best examples I can that are given to me. Drafting of these things is critical, okay? You really do want to be using an attorney so that they really tighten it up and make sure there's no other conflict. And then vet's proof required. Is that a vet's proof required that it's a dog, or is that a vet's proof required that it's not over 25 pounds? And how often do we have to get this vet's proof of not over 25 pounds? Now let's talk about the fat dog defense. You all thought I was kidding. No, there's actually a case. And the case is Mr. Snooks Condominium Association has a rule, dogs can't be over 25 pounds. I think it was pets, but I'm going to use dog. It makes more sense. All right. Now, Mr. Smith goes out and buys his little cute widow puppy, who then becomes a sausage and weighs about 40 pounds. However, the breed of this dog is really supposed to be about 15, okay? Dog said, of course, said, wait. Nah, you can't fault Mr. Smith. He got the right type of dog. He just sort of overfed it a little bit, okay? That's called the fat dog defense, all right? And the court let the owner keep the dog. So my problem when I'm asking, what can you do? I think you have two choices. One, you can try to push it, okay? And basically, if this is what you've been pushing and you're going to try to require all other owners to stand up and live by this, I would push it. Now, what can you do? One, in the condominium, I normally let your management company do its two- or three-letter approach, after which you're going to go to mandatory arbitration and ultimately litigation. I will tell you, I wish that the provision was far better worded, okay? And I would prefer it be in the declaration for the reason I've said. But that's generally what you're going to do. Back to the credibility issue. Don't have a rule and regulation, and don't have a provision in your documents, whether it's the declaration or something else, that you're not going to follow. Why? It undermines credibility. You know the best way to make sure that people comply with your documents and pay the assessments? Honest to God, in my opinion, make sure everyone knows the board means business and what they say they will do and what the documents say they will enforce. Far better than your attorneys, by the way. It's a credibility factor. With that, I think I'll open more questions. Or, oh. Okay. He's getting me back for the insult I gave him. What protection does the declaration of domicile provide? Is people meaning declaration of is like declaration of condominium or covenants and restrictions? Is that what the word declarations are meant to? Okay, you've got certain protections that a homeowner has, and basically this is like the homestead protections and stuff like that. But it isn't going to protect you against a lot of the other stuff out there. Guess what? It isn't going to protect you against the mortgage company. It's not going to protect you against the association. Okay? Why? Because the amounts that need to be paid are related to the domicile. Okay? So that's the reason. When you sign a note and mortgage, you know, if someone was allowed to use like the homestead defense to say, oh, I don't have to pay you back, mortgage company, because I live here, it's my homestead, no lender would ever lend money. Same thing with the association and its rights. To be able to protect the domiciles, whether units or lots, you literally have to have that ability to go after them. So it is a protection usually against other creditors, other types of creditors, okay? That's really where it stands. And it will protect you from most of the other creditors. Okay? Next one is rules and regulations. Must published rules and regulations. Oh, is this most? I don't know. Published rules and regulations be word for word legalese, or can it be interpretation of those words? All right. We just sort of talked a little bit about that. You can interpret them all you want. The problem is, if you go before a trier of fact, judge, jury, etc., you know, if there's an ambiguity, it should, by law, be construed against the drafter. So when you're construing something, that means it's susceptible to more than one interpretation, and that puts you at risk. The tighter you draft your documents, the better they are. I'm going to back up here a minute and tell you something. My firm's opinion. 99.8% of your documents out there are pathetic. Hope no one heard the word bad or poor. I wasn't trying to say that, oops, they made some mistakes. Most of them are horrible. Okay? Sorry. I will apologize for my profession now. That hurts you. Okay? It hurts you in lawsuits, arbitrations, mediations, enforcements, up and down the line. But if you're going to draft amendments or changes, do them well. You know, I lecture a lot, and I probably lectured on recreational vehicles, and I'm going to come back to pets in a minute, a million times. All right? I hope everybody understands it's out there. I've lectured on that topic a zillion times. I don't have a clue what a recreational vehicle is. See, you all think you do. I don't. I want someone to definitively answer for me whether a Ford Explorer is a recreational vehicle. You know, SUV. How about a motorcycle? Okay. What about a bicycle? Okay. Problem, it's not a defined term. It doesn't have a finite meaning. Therefore, it's dangerous. Okay. What if we are amending documents? Why don't we try to make it black and white? Why don't we get rid of the ambiguity? Why don't we define vehicles? Okay, we don't want certain vehicles. Great, call them what you want. Recreational vehicle, I don't care. Then we define it. Any vehicle with more than two axles. Any vehicle with more than, that's more than blank feet in length, Y feet in height, Z feet in width. More than blank pounds. Any vehicle with commercial lettering on it. Anybody don't think they can follow those crystal clear? I like empirically testable criteria. Why? Because I'm really not trying to milk my own clients. How about we draft it right to reduce the challenges and the amount of litigation we get into? Okay?